Paul sets this truth of the freedom that Christ has brought us in tension with this ongoing moral struggle that as Christians we have to know in Galatians chapter 5. He sets it forward very clearly there, and I'm going to read a few verses from it. You'll notice at the very beginning of Galatians chapter 5, we find the text which that song we've just sung echoes. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. But then in verse 13, Paul qualifies that thought. You, my brothers, were called to be free. But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. For the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the sinful nature. They are in conflict with each other, so that you do not do what you want. But if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under law. The acts of the sinful nature are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, and envy, drunkenness, orgies, and the like. I warn you, as I did before, those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the sinful nature with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. It's quite clear from that, then, that we misunderstand Paul if we think when he speaks of liberty or freedom that that means that rules, that moral norms, no longer bind our Christian lives. Clearly they do. He even quotes here from the law, summing it up in the single commandment, to love your neighbour as yourself. Sex and singleness, then. This is actually a sort of taster for a workshop which is going to be exploring healthy relationships with the opposite sex next Saturday, 9:30 to 1 o'clock. It's going to be led by Jan and Jeremy Peckham. The exploration, I'm told, will be participatory, though I've already made my jokes about that. And it would help to know, if you're coming, there is a little sheet here which you'll find at the door. It would help be helpful to Jeremy if you just put your name and telephone number down on there so they know roughly how many people to expect next Saturday. That workshop is particularly going to be dealing with what relationships are about, developing friendships with the opposite sex, how do I know he or she's the right person, how do we manage the sexual side of a relationship before marriage, setting and maintaining boundaries, that sort of thing. So it's going to be very practically oriented for single folk in our congregation. I hope you'll take advantage of it. Tonight I really want to set that subject in a wider context. And we're going to begin by looking at a passage in 1 Corinthians which has quite a lot to say about the whole subject of being single. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And it's the first of four passages we're going to look at briefly tonight, surveying this subject area. Maybe the first thing to say is to acknowledge that it is hard to survive in this world today without a sexual partner. There are two reasons for that, I think. The first is a general one, which has always been true, and that is that sex is an immensely powerful human drive. There are biological reasons for that, quite apart from anything else. The need to preserve the species, the need to mate, is an immensely important one. And God has therefore endowed all animal species, including human beings, with a huge drive in that direction. That's always been so. It's always been difficult to survive the period of singleness before we find our sex partner for life. But it's been made worse, I think, in the late 20th century by the fact that our society is peculiarly eroticized. It's not the first time it's happened. I think, actually, in many ways, ancient Rome was very similar in this respect. But we are certainly assaulted in all kinds of ways today by sexual stimulus in a way which was not always true in Western society. And therefore, there's a high degree of sexual arousal in the population today, almost all the time. And we perhaps take it for granted that it's always been like that, that it's natural for it to be like that. Actually, it has not always been so. There have been periods in history, I'm quite sure, when, generally speaking, society was more inhibited, if you want to put it that way, and where it was easier to cope with one's sexuality than it is today. So there's hormonal pressure from within and societal pressure from without. And those two things together make maintaining standards of Christian chastity very tough today. I think we need to acknowledge that to one another. That's why we need to be in prayer for folk who are single in our midst. Well, indeed, for those who are married too, because marriage is not without its sexual temptations, but particularly, perhaps, for those who are single and having to wrestle with this particular problem. 1 Corinthians 7 has some helpful things to say to the single about singleness. One thing it says, for instance, is that singleness is no virtue, but it's important to remember that it does have special opportunities and advantages. The Corinthians were getting themselves in a tangle about this. You'll see that from the very first verse of chapter 7. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. Now, that is probably a quotation from a letter the Corinthians had sent to Paul, in which they had said it is good, or literally a beautiful thing, for a man not to touch a woman. This may very well be the view of certain Greek kind of influenced people in the church who were advocating celibacy as a kind of virtue in its own right. We know that that idea, that there's more virtue in remaining celibate than in getting married, took hold in the church really quite early on. Paul doesn't contradict these Hellenistic advocates of celibacy exactly, but he does point out instead that individuals who adopt that kind of very ascetic attitude towards sex are not taking serious enough the power of the human sex drive. Since there is so much immorality, he says, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The temptation to immorality, he says, is a very strong one, especially in Hellenistic society. Very few people are physically or psychologically capable of the celibate life, he says. So marriage, at the very least, is a necessary moral prophylactic in society. It's the God-given, lawful arena where our human sexuality may find its proper outlet and fulfillment. Now, of course, Paul is not denying there are other important facets to marriage, companionship and children and so on. But Paul is at pains here to be very realistic about the sexual side of marriage as an essential part of it as an institution. That doesn't mean, though, that the Corinthian assertion in verse 1 that it's good for a man not to marry is totally false. Paul goes on to tell us in later verses that while marriage is normal, so for some people is the single state. In verses 6 and 7, for instance. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift and another has that. Now, it's not absolutely clear what concession Paul is referring to here, but I think it's rather more likely, in view of what he says in verse 7, that he's saying, I'm not insisting that you should marry, I'm merely saying that you may marry if you want. The vital point is that this whole issue of whether you're married or single is a legitimate area of Christian choice. He's not issuing a commandment here, but talking in the area of permission. God's commandments, of course, are universal rules, which are obligatory on us as Christians. We are commanded not to commit sexual immorality. But Paul says here, we're not commanded to be married or single. Both these courses of action are permitted by God. To put it another way, he says, marriage or singleness is a type of charisma, a type of gift. This is the word he uses there. The thing about gifts is they are not universal. It's gifts that makes Christians differ from one another. And Paul says that celibacy, being single, if you like, belongs to the category of gift too. Each individual must assess their own call. They mustn't try to elevate their own gift over anybody else's in this matter. Here Paul says, I wish that all men were as I am. I suspect he's using a similar kind of idiom to the one he uses in 1 Corinthians 14 when he says, I wish everybody spoke in tongues. Paul had no intention there of encouraging a church which was absolutely saturated with tongue speakers. He's merely using an idiom and saying, it's a jolly good thing if people speak in tongues. It's a perfectly permissible thing. If it happens, if it's your gift, be glad about it. In the same way he's saying here, I'm single. At least I think that's his implication. And it's a jolly good thing if you're single too. If that's your gift, rejoice in it. He doesn't want a church full of celibates. That would be to misunderstand him. But when in the sovereign good pleasure of God, this is our calling and our gift, well then, we should rejoice in it. The Christian's task is to recognize that gift or calling that they have and obey it. So, marriage or singleness are not questions really of Christian ethics, but of Christian guidance. And the obvious question is, how do I know God's guidance for me on that matter? That's a very big question. We could spend all night talking about how you discern God's will. But there are certain general principles which Paul, as a good pastor and counselor, lays down in 1 Corinthians 7 to control our attitude towards this whole business of deciding whether I ought to get married, and if I did ought to get married, finding the right person. For instance, in verses 8 and 9, to the unmarried and widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. A lot of people don't like that. What a derogatory idea of the institution of marriage. It's as if Paul sees marriage as, at the very best, the lesser of two evils. It's better to marry than to burn with passion. Well, it is a frank verse, I grant you, and it does tend to shock at first reading, but it's not as crude or dishonourable, I think, as people make out. What Paul is really saying is that both marriage and the single state are permitted to the Christian. And a major factor, therefore, in determining whether it is my calling in life to be single or married is going to be the intensity of my sexual appetite. The single person is going to have to practice self-control in sexual matters lifelong. For as we shall see later on, immorality is not an option. Well, says Paul, that is a gift. Not everybody can face it. And if a person cannot, then it is clear the single state can't be God's will for that person. The most pernicious thing, you see, about those who are trying to make celibacy a virtue instead of a vocation is that they set people a standard of human conduct which perhaps the majority of men and women are going to be incapable and not intended to maintain. And all that results, therefore, in is hypocrisy and dual standards. Now, he's saying here, both marriage and celibacy are good, both are permitted, but it is as foolish for a man or woman to try to live a permanently single life when they haven't been given the charisma, the gift of celibacy, as it is, if you like, to try and speak in tongues when you've not been given that gift. Such attempts will only end in shame and disillusion. And don't let Paul is saying, don't let hyper-spiritual romanticizing about the single state lead you into an intolerable situation of tortured sexual frustration, therefore. If God intends you to be unmarried, he will enable you to be happily unmarried. Just as, says Paul, I am. If not, then you should conclude that marriage is the right thing for you. There's some more helpful advice a little further on in verse 25. Now about virgins, he says, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think it is good for you to remain as you are. Are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. Well, again, Paul's advice here has caused laughter and sometimes offence. But again, it's important, I think, to notice that phrase, the present crisis, in verse 26. You notice? Because of the present crisis. Paul here tells us he's giving his pastoral counsel in the light of a particular situation, what he calls the present crisis. Now, you can make a couple of things of that, but I suspect Paul is referring to a specific historical situation. The imminent likelihood of persecution. Probably this is around 55 AD. The emperor Nero begins his persecution some years later, but already the prophets of the church are forecasting trouble ahead. The writing is on the wall for anybody with any kind of spiritual insight. And in such circumstances, a Christian's attitude towards marriage must be different from what it would be in settled times. A wife and family all too easily become the tools of a torturer, as Christians, of course, have found out behind the Iron Curtain in earlier decades this century. And that, I think, could be the reason for Paul's fear expressed in verse 32. I would like you to be free from concern. His interests are divided, if you like, the married person, in terms of running his family and keeping his family secure and being loyal to Christ. In times of persecution, the very devotion and love a Christian husband is commended and ought to have for his wife and children may place him in a situation of intolerable burden, where the safety of his wife and family may be used as a lever to extract some kind of denial of the faith from him. Paul is right in thinking that a single man is in a stronger situation then. So it may be that all that Paul is saying in verses 25 and 26 is that in certain circumstances, there are definite advantages in being single. It's not that it's a more virtuous life. He categorically denies that earlier. But he does agree that sometimes it's more expedient. And I think as Christians today, we may conclude there are circumstances we can imagine where singleness might be advantageous. We perhaps are not constrained in this country by fear of persecution in the immediate future, but there are other considerations of expediency that might weigh in our minds as we seek to find God's guidance on the matter about whether we ought to get married. For instance, missionary situations. Quite frankly, a single person has a great advantage in some missionary situations today. Many missionaries find themselves having to come home after only a few years in the field because they have children, for instance. No one doesn't blame them for that, but it does drastically limit their usefulness in that particular cross-cultural evangelistic context. One has to say, too, that some people who are called to extraordinary itinerant ministries may be a lot more useful to God, single, than married. The saddest feature of, I think one has to say, both John Wesley and George Whitfield's lives were their marriages when you find out about them. And it's not surprising, really, that men were so busy. Well, I'm glad my wife isn't here tonight, or she would be complaining about that too. But at least I don't spend quite as much time on horseback as Wesley did. It is questionable, I think, if a man with Wesley's kind of ministry was really wise to be married. But however that may be, it's not difficult to see that he would have found it easier to conduct his ministry if he hadn't been. So Paul's point in verse 26 is not so difficult to accept. If you're a Christian living in difficult days, or if your calling as a Christian is to some specific kinds of work, it may be that you would be wise to consider remaining single if you have the gift. It's a choice you may make, and if you're able to make the choice in that direction, you may feel it's wise to make the choice in that direction. Unfortunately, that doesn't cover everything that Paul says here. If he goes on in verse 29, what I mean, brothers, is the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they had none, and those who mourn as if they did not, and those who are happy as if they were not, and those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep, and those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them, for this world in its present form is passing away. Now, if Paul is talking here about an immediate historical crisis of persecution, it also must be acknowledged that he sees that immediate crisis against the bigger backdrop of the last times and Christ's return. These difficult days, of which we're in for a particular crop in the near future, he's saying, are to be expected, for we live in the shadow of the end of the world, and the end of the world is characterized by such things. And that, of course, makes these verses a little bit more difficult for us, because we can't interpret what Paul is saying in verse 29 as being only applicable to Christians living in Corinth in those difficult, persecuted times. Everybody has to wrestle with these verses for themselves, because the time is short for us too. The end of the world is near for us too. These words are just as applicable then to us as they were to the Corinthians. What's Paul saying here then? Well, I suggest to you that what he's saying is this. The coming of Jesus has changed our Christian attitude towards all temporal and material things. In Old Testament days, a person's whole life was tied up in the family, material property, marriage. These were the only blessings men knew about. But now that Christ has come, a whole new perspective has been opened up for us. We now see how short-lived material and temporal things are. We're looking forward to an age in which these things will be no more. That doesn't mean we despise them. Certainly not. They're God's creation. They're good. But they can no longer monopolize our interest. For as Jesus says, our treasure is laid up in heaven, not on earth. And that vital change of perspective affects a Christian's attitude to everything. His attitude toward property, his attitude towards his career. It affects his attitude towards his loss of loved ones, if they die. And Paul says it also changes a Christian's attitude towards marriage. For as Jesus made clear, in heaven they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Marriage is a part of God's first creation. It will not continue in his new world. You can talk about what that may mean. Lots of people have discussed that, but it's certainly what Jesus says. And that being so, you see, the idea of getting married can no more obsess a Christian than the idea of getting a mortgage. The things belong in the same category. They belong to this world, this temporal world. It would be as inappropriate for a Christian to be obsessed about getting married as it would be to be obsessed about getting a mortgage. It's not that there's anything actually bad about marriage. Absolutely not. It's an ordinance of God. It is good. But in the light of Christ, Paul seems to be saying it should assume less importance than it did in the days when this world was the only one we knew about, and where marriage and family and having masses of children and so on were all the blessings that God could give you and all the blessings you knew about. For as Paul has said, singleness has advantages, especially for a person motivated by spiritual priorities. Verse 32, I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord, but a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. And his interests are divided. There's no question that what Paul is saying here is true. When you're married, you have a domestic situation to look after, it brings anxiety with it. It is easy to be single-minded as a single person about Christian things, if that is God's calling to you. So Paul gives his advice in verse 36. If anyone thinks he's acting improperly toward the virgin he's engaged to, and if she's getting along in years and he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He's not sinning. They should get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who's under no compulsion but has control over his own will and who has made up his mind not to marry the virgin, this man also does the right thing. So then he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry her does even better. Again, people have their tongue in their cheek when they read Paul there. It does hinge a little bit, actually, this whole text on exactly what you think Paul means here. If you look in the Greek text, you will see there is an ambiguity here as to whether Paul is actually addressing an engaged couple who are deciding whether to go ahead with their marriage plans or not, which is how our translation renders it, or whether he's dealing with a father who is deciding whether to arrange a marriage for his daughter, his virgin daughter, or not. And you can take it either way. Similarly, verse 36, this phrase, getting along in years, I don't like that translation very much. What it literally says in the Greek is, beyond the point of no return. Now, admittedly, it could refer to the age of the young lady in question. One recalls those words of Jane Austen in Pride and Prejudice. God, how ashamed I should be of not being married before the age of 23, isn't it? But it's equally possible that it refers to the degree to which the young couple concerned are head over heels in love, beyond the point of no return. One commentator has even gone so far as to translate this, if he, that is the young man in question, is oversexed. That, I think, is putting it a little unfairly, but it makes the point. Whichever way you take it, the principal application is not really in serious doubt. Paul is saying, look, God is happy if you get married, but just as happy if you stay single. And there may be situations, like the situation we Corinthians are in right at this moment, when he is even happier if you remain single than if you get married, because there are definite advantages to it. So he's saying, don't be pressurized into marriage. If you're not passionately in love with someone, and you're able to control your sexual desire, then why allow yourself to feel you're missing out on the most important thing in the world? You're not. Singleness is not a synonym for emotional maladjustment. It's perfectly possible to be happily unmarried, and in certain respects it's positively better to be unmarried. Now, admittedly, the world can't understand that. It can't bear the thought of living alone. But for the Christian, singleness never means that. We never live alone. We are not unfulfilled. We are never unloved. The world places a stigma on singleness, but there's no place in the church for that. For we know God does sometimes call a person to singleness in order to do a work for him nobody else can do. We don't just need Paul's example to prove that to us. We have the example of Jesus himself on that score. So there's a challenge to us, isn't there, in this chapter? To be prepared to be what God calls us to be. To rest joyfully content with who we are. In a world where everybody is forever pairing off. And is liable to call you queer if you don't follow their obsession. We need to feel secure about this. We don't just differ in our standards of sexual morality. We Christians differ also in the degree of urgency with which we confront this issue of getting married. And that's really what 1 Corinthians 7 is all about. So much for 1 Corinthians 7 then. Lots for you to think about there and talk about, no doubt, over coffee. Let's look at another passage. We're not going to take as long over the last three, be reassured. Matthew 6, verses 27 to 30. This is a section from the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is talking about the whole question of chastity. It applies to everybody, married or single, but I think it has particular relevance to a person in the single phase of their life. What Jesus is saying here is, chastity begins in the thought life. Fantasies, he's saying, can be sinful. Notice then what he says in verse 27. I've said 6, I think I mean 5. Sorry. Matthew 5. Heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, I think there are several things that we need to clarify here in order that we do not exaggerate what Jesus is saying. One early church father, for instance, interpreted verses 29 and 30 to imply that he ought to castrate himself. That isn't what Jesus intends, I'm quite sure. Jesus is simply saying here, you need to be ruthless with anything in your life that leads you in the direction of sin. You need to be tough on yourself about this. Secondly, I do not believe personally that Jesus is saying here that all sexual fantasies are in and of themselves wrong. He's particularly dealing here with sexual fantasies, with mental lust, after another man's wife. In other words, he's talking about fantasizing about something which it would be sinful to actually do, to have adultery with that woman. That is not the same at all as saying that sexual fantasies are always blanket condemned. I mean, a married man away from home for a few weeks. Isn't he going to fantasize about being home with his wife? Can there be anything possibly wrong with a married man doing that? Wouldn't it be a little strange if he didn't? Or a single man who plans to get married. A girl too. Isn't it perfectly natural that they should fantasize a little about what getting married is going to be like? Or even a single person who hasn't yet met their future partner, but is longing for it. Isn't it natural that such a person should fantasize about that individual as yet with no face, as yet unknown? My own judgment is, of course, it's natural. Fantasies which are misdirected towards potential objects of our sexual desire, which we could never have, which we could never, if you like, make our wife or our husband, they certainly are rebuked by Jesus here. They're sinful. We're desiring something which it would be quite wrong to do, and Jesus says that's where the sin begins, in desiring it. But that doesn't mean all fantasies are sinful. And I would like to lift a burden of guilt from a lot of young single folk who, I think, through an over-strict interpretation of that verse, find themselves excessively burdened with guilt on this issue. That raises, of course, the vexed question of masturbation. That's a subject which people find very difficult to talk about in public or from the pulpit. You'll very rarely hear it mentioned. And it embarrasses both the preacher and the people to talk about it. I have to say, the statistics, such as they are, indicate that a very high proportion of men and women have in fact masturbated. And I think it is also important to point out that masturbation is never proscribed in the Bible. I think it's extremely hard to take a blanket view again and say, masturbation in and of itself is sinful. I don't know on what you would base that. And I personally don't feel single people should be burdened with guilt if they need to resort to this means of sexual release sometimes. You might even adapt Paul's earlier words in 1 Corinthians 7, it is better to masturbate than to burn with lust. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that because it's not sinful, it's always helpful. It is possible for masturbation to become a habitual, even obsessive thing. And that's not good. It becomes a form of addiction that drains our energies that we could be investing in more creative things. And it leads us to regard sex, if we're not careful, as something narcissistic, a form of self-indulgence, self-pleasure. Because the whole thing about it, of course, is that it's not a relationship. It's not an act of giving to somebody else. So I think my verdict on masturbation is, don't feel guilty about it, it's no big deal, it's no sin. But if it's got a hold on you, if it's an addiction, you should take steps to break the addiction. Just like you would take steps to stop biting your nails or drinking alcohol. It's not doing you any good. Let's turn to another passage. 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 to 20. Here's another passage in Paul, where he tells us, it matters what we do with our bodies. It matters what we do with our bodies. Let me just read to you the appropriate words here. In verse 12 and following, everything is permissible for me, but not everything is beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food for the stomach and the stomach for food, but God will destroy them both. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Don't you know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Corinth was renowned as an immoral city, and it's clear from this chapter that the Christians who lived there were not unaffected by that environment. They were not distancing themselves from the immorality of their Hellenistic world. On the contrary, they were participating in loose sexual conduct. And in verses 12 and 13, we discover some of the excuses they were employing to rationalize this licentious behavior. They were saying things like, everything is permissible for me. See, a theological argument. I'm free, like Galatians 5 says. Christ has made me free. I'm not subject to the condemnation of God's law any longer, so surely I can do as I please. On verse 13, they were quoting this popular proverb, food for the stomach and the stomach for food. In other words, sex is a natural appetite, just like hunger, so there can be nothing wrong with satisfying it, can there? Both these excuses are still in current use today. You come across them all the time. Rules of sexual chastity are a cramping restriction on your self-fulfillment. Sexual fulfillment is necessary to healthy psychological development. To deny yourself such experience is to fall victim to all kinds of damaging inhibition. In any case, sex is an instinct like eating, so what's wrong with enjoying it? You hear people say things like this all the time. Well, Paul would have had no more time for that sort of 20th century version of these excuses than he had for the first century version of them. He says in verse 9, don't be deceived. People will offer you all kinds of seductive argument for why it's okay to indulge in extramarital sexual behavior. They're liars, he says. Don't be deceived. People who unrepentantly are sexually immoral will not inherit the kingdom of God, he says. The reason? Verse 13, the body is not meant for sexual immorality, but the Lord, he says. It matters what we do with our bodies, for several reasons. Firstly, because our bodies are part of us. We human beings are integrated wholes, a fusion of mental and emotional and physical and spiritual potentials that can't be disentangled. So what you do with your body affects your whole personality. And this is particularly true of sexual behaviour. We misunderstand sex, Paul says in this passage, if we think of it as a purely external act. That maybe is what he's getting at when he says in verse 18, all other sins a man commits are outside his body, but he who sins sexually sins against his own body. It's a strange expression. But I wonder if Paul is really pointing out here that, according to the Bible, in sexual intercourse, an interpenetration of personal identity takes place. The two become one flesh. And so Paul seems to suggest that unlike murder or theft, sexual immorality is something you can never commit in cold blood. It always involves you, because of that one flesh bond between the participants. It always involves you. Part of your personality is inevitably given away in the act. Says Paul in verse 15, that's even true if the other person concerned is just a prostitute. If the relationship is as casual as that, that one flesh bonding is still enacted. And people talk about casual sex, but there really is no such thing. Paul says all sex is serious. And although it is very hard to tell somebody who's 16 or 18 that this is so, when you have met a few people in the aftermath of the sexually permissive revolution, who at the age of 28 or 30 have at last decided they want to get married, they want to find somebody special, and you talk to them, you will find they will confirm exactly what the apostle here says. They regret giving themselves away to so many people, so casually, because now they want to find one person to invest themselves in and give themselves to wholeheartedly. They find it's extremely hard to do so. They find they have given away that which they cannot easily reclaim. This old bit, you know, about giving away virginity, there is something in it. You can only be really special for one person. If you want to be really special for one person, you better hang on to it. Not only is it a sin against your own body, a sin against your own self, Paul is also clear that this sort of behavior is a sin against God too, because he has a claim over our bodies. See how he puts that? The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Don't you know that your bodies are members of Christ? See, when Jesus was raised from the dead, he took his body to heaven with him. And the astonishing thing about the gospel is it says he intends that we shall take our bodies to heaven with us too. Our bodies are part of us. Already that right of ownership has been established by the indwelling Holy Spirit. That's why he says in verse 19, don't you know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you've received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honour God with your body. Your body belongs to God, he says. What you do with it matters, not just because you can damage yourself and deprive yourself if you mishandle it, but you are depriving God of something that belongs to him too. It's an offense against your Christian discipleship. So he says in verse 18, flee from sexual immorality. Keep away from it. Maybe he has in mind that famous story of Joseph, you remember, who fled from Potiphar's wife rather than risk her seductive advances. Sometimes fleeing is the only safe policy. Getting away. If we take unnecessary risks with immoral thoughts, like Jesus was talking about, with immoral books or immoral films or immoral parties, we place ourselves in a situation of danger. That's part of what Jesus meant, perhaps, when he said, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Be ruthless with those things in your life that lead you in the direction of moral compromise, he's saying. Flee sexual immorality. It's the only safe policy. And that brings me to the last passage, which we'll look at briefly this evening. 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 3 to 7. 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 3 to 7. Now, here again, we are embarrassed a little bit by the fact that the text can be interpreted two ways. The way you will read it in the NIV, in the main body of the text, is, it is God's will that you should be holy, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honourable, not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God, and that in this matter no one should wrong his brother or take advantage of him. Now what the Greek text actually says in verse 3 is, or in verse 4 is, it is God's will that you should be holy, that you should avoid sexual immorality, and that each person should obtain a vessel of their own in a way that is holy and honourable. Now you can see that obtain a vessel of their own is obviously an idiom for something. What's it an idiom for? Some people say you should interpret as possess his vessel. That is, as we have here, should control his body. The vessel is the body. So you should possess your vessel. You should keep control of it. But the verb doesn't actually mean possess. It means obtain. It's very hard to see how you can go around obtaining your body. Equally, it's difficult to know why Paul should put this emphasis on his own body. I mean, who else's body is he going to go around controlling? Similarly, I think it's hard to know how you defraud your brother or take advantage of him in the matter of his body. I don't think that's what Paul is talking about. I think the margin is right, personally. When it says that vessel doesn't mean body, it means wife. There is one example in the New Testament of this idiom in 1 Peter, where the word vessel clearly does mean a wife. And so what I think Paul is saying here is, it is God's will you should be holy, that you should avoid sexual immorality, and that each of you should learn to obtain a wife of his own in a way that is holy and honourable, and not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God, and that in this matter no one should wrong his brother or take advantage of him, defraud him, literally. I think that makes much better sense of the passage. Paul is giving advice here, then, the only place really there is advice in the New Testament, if I'm right, on how Christians are to view this business of marital courtship, going about finding a partner. Paul repeats his advice in 1 Corinthians 6, that we should avoid sexual immorality. But he goes beyond that to talk about finding a wife, finding a partner in a way that is holy and honourable, not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God, and that in this matter we should not wrong our brother or take advantage of him. In other words, in this business of finding a partner for ourselves, we must remember we have Christian brothers and sisters that we're in the same fellowship with. We play fast and loose in the boy-girl game. We go around injuring other people. Other people are also fond of that girl, fond of that boy. And it can cause fractures in the church. You can finish up with people not being able to come to this church anymore because there's so-and-so there, and they feel so embarrassed that so-and-so is there. Now, Paul is saying we need to use discretion and self-control in this matter, not just so that we don't hurt ourselves and hurt that person who we are perhaps thinking of going out with, but there are other people who are potentially involved too in this business of looking for a marital partner. And we must be careful we don't hurt them either. The chief word Paul uses here then is in a way that is holy and honourable and not in passionate lust. Nowhere do we find in the New Testament rules laid down about how far we are permitted to go in expressing our sexual feelings for somebody before marriage. Put it bluntly, there are no guidelines on petting. This matter is going to be thoroughly discussed, I'm sure, by Jeremy and Jan on Saturday. And it's well past seven now, so I don't have to feel I have to get embroiled in that. What I will tell you, though, is there are these two particular pieces of apostolic instruction, which, if you like, form a ring around our feet in this whole area. The first is avoid immorality. Sexual intercourse outside marriage is out. And if we are wise, we don't drive close to the edge of that particular cliff. Secondly, he says, when you choose a partner, don't be ruled by lust. One of the great hazards of becoming physically involved at an early stage in a boy-girl relationship is that it clouds our judgment. Our bodies accelerate or leave our minds and our hearts behind. That, says Paul, is not the way for a Christian to find the right person. Beware of becoming so physically obsessed with the other person. You cannot determine objectively God's will for you in the relationship, he says. He doesn't lay down some of what we used to call the 18-inch rule. No, there were boys who used to take 18-inch rules with them to the CU meeting. I remember, that's long ago. That shows you how things have changed. He doesn't say, no touching before you're engaged. I mean, there are some people in the old days, you know, who used to say when the pastor says you may kiss the bride, that was the first time you were allowed to. No, he doesn't say that. But he does caution us that our premarital relationships need to be disciplined if we want to honour God in them and find a route to a happy and a holy marriage. I found a little diagram which Walter Trobisch uses in a book I will recommend, I Married You. I'm not sure whether it's still in print. I hope it is. But he uses this little diagram that I put at the bottom here to illustrate the triangle of a marital relationship. Love, falling in love, the whole business of saying this person is the special person for me. Sexual union, the business of sleeping together. And marriage, the legal contract. These are the triangle, he says. It's important to realize that in different cultures, you enter marriage via different what's the plural of apex? Different corners of this triangle. For instance, in some cultures, you get married before you've fallen in love. You're married off by your parents. So you enter at the vertex, and then you have to make progress towards the other two. There are cultures, I think it has to be said too, where it is very common for a marital relationship to be entered via the sexual union corner, where it's not possible for people to be regarded as married until the first baby comes along. But in our Western culture, partly because of the Christian influence upon our heritage, it is normal for marital relationships to begin on the love corner. People fall in love. And I think there's a lot to commend in that particular route into the marital relationship. If that's the way it is for us, the goal of our courtship period, you see, is to make progress along those parallel lines towards marriage and sexual union, with the goal of hitting the other two corners simultaneously. What happens, of course, if we let ourselves be ruled by lust, as Paul would say, is that the lines don't go in parallel. We get to the bottom right-hand corner long before we get to the top one. Not so good. Commitment and tenderness should advance together. I suggest to you that's the way a Christian couple ought to think about conducting their courtship. They've fallen in love. They're planning to get married. Then the game is to keep those lines parallel. So that during that period of courtship, of course, there is a growing expression of physical tenderness. There ought to be. I find it quite ridiculous to suggest that a couple can sort of jump into bed on their honeymoon night, having never touched one another before. And I'm not quite sure how such a marriage would ever proceed. But it must be under control. It must not be ruled by lust. It must be that even progression, reaching the other side simultaneously. I like that illustration, and I commend the whole book to you. The other book I'll commend to you is this one by John White. It's called Eros Defiled. And the reason I recommend it is because it's the only book I know that deals responsibly with a number of issues which are of concern to young singles, which you get very, very little advice from church upon, generally speaking. Masturbation, for instance, is dealt with in a chapter here. And it's dealt with very maturely and wisely, I think. There are a number of other things which are dealt with very wisely here, like homosexuality. It's the only book I know that deals, from a Christian point of view, with those subjects. And I do recommend you get a hold of a copy of it and study the chapters that are relevant perhaps to your particular need, but also just keep it on the bookshelf because you will meet people who will need your help at some time in your life in these sorts of areas.